Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, I am so excited to be talking about movies this week. Oh my God. Backrooms is kind of rad. I've heard some mixed things from people. We're going to be talking about Backrooms, new A24 film, young director Kane Parsons, 20 years old, taking on this project, his first film, coming out to tremendous reviews, tremendous success at the box office. We're going to talk about the box office for Backrooms. We're going to take a look at Spider-Noir, this new show starring Nick Cage over on Amazon Prime. It's like an 8-episode miniseries in the spirit of Spider-Man, but it's also set in like an alternate kind of 30s, 40s thing. Anyway, we're going to talk about Spider-Noir. Mixed reviews on Spider-Noir. Stick around for it. We got hot takes for you. We're going to take a look at some upcoming trailers. We got trailers for Primetime. We got Fatherland. That's a trailer which we just talked about. It came from a couple weeks ago. End of Oak Street has a new trailer out. How to Rob a Bank. Onslaught. I got a couple others. Huge trailer park. Action-packed trailer park this week on the pod. Before we get to everything, the news. I'm going to be honest. The big story this week is Backrooms' insane success. And I do want to talk about that. That's going to lead perfectly into box office. That's going to walk right into the review. We got a whole outline here. But before we get to it, a quick look at another part of the movie-making business. Zack Snyder is apparently doing a reimagining of John Carpenter's Escape from New York, 1981 picture starring Kurt Russell, right? What do you know about this, Andy?
Well, not much outside of this announcement. We all know, are familiar with Zack Snyder's style, which means there'll be a lot of slow-mo happening. We really don't have any details about that. The project's still in very early production. What we do know is that Escape from New York is a John Carpenter classic where Kurt Russell plays the outlaw Snake Plissken, on where they've transformed all of Manhattan into this giant prison. The president of the United States crash lands onto this island, and Snake Plissken has to get him out, has to battle other organizations and nefarious people. It's an action classic of the 80s. There was a sequel in the 90s called Escape from L.A., so that's our setup. It's an actioner. It's very much due for an update. So I think this will probably be pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, first film, Escape from New York, came out in 81. Escape from L.A. came out in 96. All right, so 15 years later, Carpenter got back together with Kurt Russell and friends and made that follow-up film. That's the one that's got that goofy Kurt Russell surfing gif that like looks terrible, but like I'm sure at the time it was fine. It's right on par with like GoldenEye 007 not GoldenEye, one of those Pierce Brosnan movies had Bond movies has some bad CGI in there too, of him like surfing down a thing. It's the one with the ice in it. Anyway, you were right. They've tried to kind of get this movie off the ground before. Actually, it turns out New Line had a run of trying to get Brett Ratner to make this movie. Looks like Gerard Butler was attached to star to that project. In 2017, Robert Rodriguez was going to do a version of this movie with 20th Century Fox. That was involving Lee Wannell from Saw. Radio Silence, the more recent horror directors who were doing Scream, they were going to do a version of this. They just did Ready or Not 2 that Andy covered on the pod a few weeks ago. Review on the channel. It looks like they've been trying to get this off the ground for a while. Just has not really happened. I'm going to be honest. I don't have a lot of faith in Zack Snyder. When was the last movie we watched for the pod for him? It was that Army of the Dead, right? It was, what happens to Army
the
of
Netflix.
The Dead? Yeah, Netflix. Bunch of mercenaries go out to zombie-ridden Las Vegas to try to crack a safe and get out of
rob
there.
Rob a bank, yeah.
Yeah, it had some cool ideas, but it really struggled, I think, in like setting. It just felt a lot like they were just kind of shooting on green screen, and it didn't, I don't know, it didn't have the gas, didn't have the motion that like the premise kind of promises and the cast promised. You had Big Dave Bautista in there. He did a couple other movies for Netflix. Rebel Moon, right, that we did not cover on the pod.
Part 1 and 2.
And then a director's cut of Rebel Moon, because that's the whole thing with Snyder, right? He's got those DC movies behind him. I don't have a lot of faith in Zack Snyder. How about you, Andy? You think this is going to be something cool?
Zack Snyder does know how to do action, and you know he does have a little bit of a following. I think this is a better fit for his directing style. You know, you don't have to give him a whole lot of story. It's all style. It's all vibes. It's all aura. I think that's where he kind of excels. You know, something like 300 is all of those things. So I think he'll do a fine job.
Yeah. I don't know who's going to play our mercenary Snake Plissken at the front. We had Kurt Russell originally. Gerard Butler was cast at one point in the history of the project. Get your picks in now.
Momoa.
Mail it off script.
He doesn't even have to change clothes.
It's got to be Jason Momoa. Yeah, it's the only answer. Yeah. Anyway, yes. Yeah. Let us know what you think. Hit us on socials. We'll talk about it next week. Let's talk about Backrooms. This is the biggest story of the week, like I said at the top, by far. Backrooms has had insane success in the horror space, insane success at the box office. It's the biggest film A24 has ever got together. And with the youngest director at the front, Kane Parsons, 19 when he directed the film, 20 now. Boy, it's just seems kind of like a Hail Mary project that's paid off bigly. What do you know about it, Andy?
This is a historic weekend at the movies for a number of reasons. First off, Backrooms made $81 million domestic, $118 million globally. Kane Parsons becoming the youngest director at 20 to ever hit the number one spot in the domestic box or at the box office at all. This movie was made for $10 million. That's, you know, indie budget money, and it's going to do even more. And it's nuts because it's based off a YouTube series that Kane Parsons created about 4 years ago called Backrooms. I actually went back and I'll talk about this more in the review, but I went back and watched some of it. It's really cool stuff, and it's someone who has the eye of the internet generation, who grew up watching YouTube stuff, creating stuff for YouTube, and knows what that audience want, and then transfer that to the screen. But it's nuts because Obsession has also done really well, came at $27 million in its third weekend. The first movie since E.T. to make more money in its third weekend than its first. It started with $16 million in week one at $27 million, and $150 million globally so far. They're thinking it's going to top out around $250-300 million off a sub $1 million budget is insane. And what's really crazy is that these two YouTube movies have upended the juggernaut that is Star Wars. The Mandalorian and Grogu is doing fine. $24 million at the box office again for nearly $250 million globally, but it's third. And what is happening? These established long franchise projects are just bombing for this YouTube, like these people no one have ever heard of, these original properties, and it's really kind of exciting. The last statistic I'll say before I hand it over to you was this has been the best May since 2019, which was a banner year at the movies. A little movie called Avengers Endgame came out in May of 2019. So how different the landscape is, where the things that used to dominate the box office are nowhere to be seen, and they're being embarrassed by small original creators on micro-budget films.
Yeah, it's such an exciting time to be a fan of the movies, right? Like, so many people are coming out, people from all walks of life, right? Whether you're a child or a senior citizen in Mandalorian and Grogu, or you're anywhere in between in any of these other movies. We've covered them all on the pod. You can check out the reviews. We had a couple of them last week. Obsession's a banger. And really, like, is kind of getting put, it's not getting pushed over, but it's been out a couple weeks. I know, Backrooms is getting a lot more attention, but yeah, like, Obsession is secretly kind of the white horse here in the story. Like, a third weekend climb doesn't happen. I can't remember the last time it happened in our lifetime. Like, I'd have to go look it up. I couldn't even tell you what it is. Like, and they're saying there's a chance it does it again this next weekend and makes even more money. Universal just pulled it off of its streaming window. They're just going to keep it in theaters for the next 90, I think. They're going to keep it in theaters as long as they can because it's having this huge runway success. And that was made on $750,000, less than $1 million budget. It's tracking to make over $100 million. Insane, right? And if that's not the big story, to me, Backrooms is a close second, right? Obviously, like, Backrooms having this huge success. I'm with Andy. I went back and looked at some of those old Backrooms videos. That first video he ever uploaded.
Creepy.
It's creepy. 22 video playlist. That first video is 81 million views. It is so crazy to look at that number and see how many people have clicked on that video and started and watched it. And then you look at its success and it's like, oh, okay, of course. Like, of course people are into this. And it's weird because Backrooms is this sort of, I don't know. It's lore, right? Nobody owns it. Anybody can make something out of it. So
because
it comes from the internet, like, it's this juicy seedbed of creativity that I think a lot of people want to dive into, especially young folks who are turning out. But the other big story, the one I've been couching behind these other two this whole time, dude, Disney has got to fire some people and figure something out because they are getting dragged
here. It's so over.
I know these are both horror movies, which is very different from Mandalorian and Grogu, but dude, nobody in these films cares about Mandalorian and Grogu. None of them. Every one of them is walking up to the box office and looking at Mandalorian and Grogu and laughing and then getting their cool movie instead. It is a joke movie. Like, you look awful compared to this stuff. The optics are bad. And yeah, you made money. You might make your money back after marketing and everything by the end of Mandalorian and Grogu, but it's the worst Star Wars has ever done. It's the first they've been out in 7 years. They're getting smoked, absolutely smoked by two small budget horrors from a 26 and a 20-year-old. It's crazy. Dude, Disney needs some new juice. It's bad. They don't have it right now.
The Mandalorian and Grogu suffered a 70% decline in its second week. This is what we used to call the Marvel drop, because the Marvel movies would eventually became to where all the super fans would go see them week one, and then no one would go see it week two. And that's what's happening to The Mandalorian. I mean, the franchise, it shows the limit of franchises, because Obsession and Backrooms may both spawn their own franchises because they've been so successful. But The Mandalorian it has the opposite. It has negative word of mouth. Everyone who's seen it was like, well, it's okay. Just kind of say, wait for Disney Plus. You know, so that's what we said. Save it for streaming. And no one's going to see it. And it's kind of a movie for no one, despite it being a four quadrant, you know, trying to get the family to come out and see it. There's things that are for kids. There's things that are a lot of stuff that's not for kids. That's more for adults. And it ends up not really having an audience. And the other thing about Backrooms and Obsession, those are both rated R films. Like, it's hard to get people to come out for that. And the fact that they're both embarrassing Star Wars is just, it's something else.
It's so weird, because I think the thing that made Mandalorian and Grogu, or at least the property of the Mandalorian, interesting following like the Skywalker, the new trilogy, right? Episodes 7, 8, and 9. Was that it was on Disney Plus. It was a little different. It was a little small, and it was just such a maverick story, right? Like, it's the same kind of thing that made Andor successful. Like, you don't have to know a whole lot. It's just this bounty hunter guy who's got a cool helmet, who's looking for something when he stumbles across this small alien. That first season of Mandalorian was great, right? But as they iterated and they kind of started going back to the same thing that makes Star Wars the same thing Star Wars has always been, like, it just kind of got dull. And yeah, suddenly you got Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni like turning out just a by the numbers safe script where nothing changes and nobody grows in The Mandalorian and Grogu. Every character starts the same and ends the same. It's crazy. There is no character growth. There's no change. There's no hero's journey. Like, you compare that to like a couple of YouTubers just getting out there and smoking them, right? People are saying this is the beginning of a new movement. Like, this is something different. And maybe it is, right? Or maybe Hollywood takes all the wrong lessons, like they always do, and they do something stupid and make something lame after this. But, like, it is a very exciting time to be at the movies. Like Andy said, biggest May since 2019. Such a cool time to be going to the movies, right? With friends and family and talking about stuff about this. So, like, as movie fans, I like this. What I gotta know, Andy, do you think Backrooms is getting a sequel? Deadline put something out about this. $81 million opening at A24. It's their biggest opening ever. Seems like a layup. I don't know if anything's been announced yet. What do you know?
They're at least talking about it. What we know so far is that they are going to do Backrooms 2 or some sort of sequel. Kane Parsons is looking for a new screenwriter to help. He didn't write the screenplay for the first one, I do want to point out. They did hire a screenwriter. He's more of a director camera guy. So that's all we know so far, and they would be dumb not to, because the thing about Backrooms, and we'll talk about this more in the review, is that it's an idea, and he is telling one backroom story, but there is not a definitive one. It's just kind of a place, an idea where many stories could take place. The whole thing originates on 4chan, which is really nuts. On like, someone just posted a picture and wrote like a little blurb story, and then it just morphed into this video series and now the movie. So it's kind of a crazy the way that has come about. But yeah, I mean, they'd be foolish not to do a sequel, you know, make it bigger budget, bigger stars, go all out, get even weirder with it. I think it's bound to happen.
Yeah, it seems like such a layup. It reminds me a lot of how I felt about watching that new Final Destination Bloodlines movie. Like, it's a horror formula that you can just run in like any direction with. It's so open-ended. You can tell any story in this setting, anything you want. You can do a tragedy, a romance, like you can do all kinds of stuff in here, and then just weave horror right through the middle of it. Backrooms is this just big setting where you can tell a story in this big bombastic way. I'm glad they got a screenwriter to help him out with it. We're going to talk about the film in just a second here. Maybe that's a good time to just transition into it. But for what it's worth, like, I think Parsons has some strong work here. I think they should absolutely stick with him for what's next. It definitely has some room to grow. The Backrooms is not a perfect film. It does have some problems for sure. But this is a really good start. And I think A24 committing to this and not just making some cheesy, hacky Hollywood version where they like just take the Backrooms and give it to Jon Favreau over Disney, right? Or like a 55-year-old who's made a bunch of movies who's like, yeah, I can make that. They would have done it wrong. They would have lit it wrong. It would have been dark and lame, and it would have been like Insidious, and somebody would have walked through the Backrooms in the dark with like a lantern, you know? And it's like, that's not what we're doing here. Like, it's a different thing. So buying into this, putting in this budget, like getting the producers on board to make Backrooms with Kane Parsons, an impressive list we'll get to in just a second. Like, it's all paid dividends. I think this is the lesson people should be taking from A24 here, is buy in big on creative. Like, sometimes it pays off, you know? And you know, bring in good producers. Good God, the producers on this movie, the producer list is rad. Anyway, we got to talk about the film. Any other thoughts before we jump into it, Andy?
Real quick, just want to finish out the box office. Michael earned another $12 million over the weekend for a global haul of $846 million. I mean, one of the biggest movies of the year. We're going to definitely get a sequel to that as well. And a small movie called The Breadwinner came in at just $7.4 million. Do you know anything about The Breadwinner, Zach?
Yeah, it's a new Nate Bargatze movie. And he's a white dad stand-up comic who's in like a 90-minute comedy caper where he's got to, like, I don't know, step up and be responsible. And he wears, you know...
right, so the story really, around this...
That's what I know about it.
Right, so the comedian... I didn't even bother looking up the premise. I really don't care, but Nate Bargatze, the stand-up comedian, was apparently saying, you know, they're not letting you make comedy movies anymore. I'm going to make a comedy movie, show you that comedy still works. And I think it's specifically like a family-friendly comedy film. And it just kind of bombed at the box office, $7.4 million. No one interested in seeing this at all. Again, people just have too many options. So again, if the stuff to take the kids to see, which is The Mandalorian or I guess The Breadwinner, is not good, people will just stay home. They can entertain themselves in lots of other ways.
Yeah, I caught this awesome tweet earlier this week from at Alter Streams. Big fan of the new genre from the 2020s of comedian vanity projects that are awful and release wide to zero audience. Latest is Nate Bargatze, The Breadwinner, also includes Joe Coy's Easter Sunday from earlier this year. The Machine, starring Burt Kreischer, which I thought went straight to Netflix, but no, that was definitely in theaters. And About My Father, starring Sebastian Maniscalco and Robert De Niro. I forgot about that movie. Yeah, it came out...
Although this looks so bad.
It looks... yeah, like stand-up comics who got a couple Netflix specials and some studios like, yeah, shit, we'll throw $15 million at that. Who knows? Yeah, maybe...
Not so cool. Easy, is it?
Not so easy, man. Let's talk about Backrooms. It's time. I'm going to be taking the summary, so please excuse me. Funny delivery. The film is Backrooms. So... Clark is an architect who is working at a furniture store, Captain Clark's Ottoman Empire, actually, where he, Captain Clark, is doing his best to get by. His partner has been in law school, things are not working out, and with a lot of stress on the line and maybe some drinking and some anger issues, Clark has essentially driven himself out of house and home. He's got a divorce, he's sleeping out of the furniture store. Fortunately, he's got a therapist in Mary, played by Renata Ronzva, who talks him through some of these situations, tries to get him to revisit these times when he was angry or did the wrong thing and kind of... I don't know, reinterpret things. And it's one of these nights where Clark's sleeping in the furniture store where he stumbles into the Backrooms, this kind of liminal space where a lot of office walls and ceiling tiles and fluorescent lights and grungy carpet and this funny yellow wallpaper just span off vastly and endlessly into any sort of maze of directions. Every hallway a corner, every corner a hallway, doors, windows, all kinds of crazy kooky things going on in there. Turns out there's more going on in the Backrooms that meets the eye, and that it may not be as safe a space as maybe Clark might hope, somewhere he can explore and find something new as an architect. But an architect and a therapist walk into the Backrooms, and we have Kane Parsons, The Backrooms, a 2-hour or 1-hour 50-minute feature from A24, their biggest budget film to date that has paid off beautifully. Parsons is a YouTuber. This is where he started the series with Backrooms, a 22-video series. He is only 20 years old at the time of making this film, making him a very young filmmaker. And with its huge success this weekend, both from its viral notoriety online and from curious horror goers who are, looking for the next big thing at the movies following this month's obsession, Backrooms has been a crazy success. It is odd. It is strange. I'm so looking forward to talk about it. Andy, what did you think of Backrooms?
I really enjoyed this and really went along for the ride. And I think that that is key because I've talked to a lot of my friends who like horror who didn't really enjoy this, but I just went with it. It's a little slow getting going because it's taking time to meet our characters. Clark, who's really frustrated with his life in a lot of ways. And then, of course, Mary, the psychiatrist, who is kind of fighting her own demons. But by the time we get down there, I just found it really effective. It is really creepy, gets under your skin, and you're trying to figure out, like Clark, what is going on here? And he becomes obsessed because his life is so mundane and so kind of not going anywhere that this is the new exciting thing. And it reminded me of so many things that I didn't expect. Like it reminds me of Portal, the video game, which Kane Parsons has actually cited as an inspiration of these kind of endless rooms. There's bits that remind me a little bit of The Shining, of the Blair Witch. So there's all these things that are creepy. It is not quite as scary as something like Obsession. Like it's not that kind of movie. It's more of like a psychological thriller. There's lots of chasing, that sort of thing. So I really dug this. I really went with it. And like I said, it inspired me to go back and check out the Backrooms on Kane Parsons' YouTube channel. And I watched the first one, which is the kind of the one that with 80 million views that has kicked it all off. And I watched some of the subsequent ones where we kind of learned a little bit of lore about where there's like some sort of research institute that knows about the Backrooms and is trying to navigate them. And we see that also reflected in the movie.
Yeah, I think the thing that works the most about this movie is it's the Backrooms. Like, and I know it sounds silly because that's the kind of the name of the film, but really, like, it's not called Captain Clark's Omnian Empire. It's not called like The Therapist or what's her book, Through a Window or whatever it is. Like, something no, it's like just, that. It's very explicitly labeled Backrooms because that's kind of the film, right? It reminds me of a movie where people say like, oh, well, it's a movie set in New York and New York is as much a character as everybody else. Really though, Backrooms is kind of what's happening. Like our characters are just kind of like the stick of celery that you put the Backrooms peanut butter on to eat your, like, it's just the delivery device to get us down there. They're just our kind of like walking stick as we get in there because the series on YouTube doesn't have a lot of that. Like it's mostly self-driven. It's mostly like camera footage, which is nice. Cause that's the way that's the way the film starts. We get this wonderful intro sequence, mostly handheld, where we have somebody running down in the Backrooms who's panicked and frightened and immediately opens us up with some danger, which is juicy. Cause I remember watching the trailers and thinking, I hadn't watched the series before. I don't actually know what's dangerous about the Backrooms. What down there is scary or bad. So they give us this wonderful intro on the front. Very, very good stuff. Some people say it's some of the best stuff in the movie. Then we get into like therapy with Clark and Mary. And it's just like, it's just the brakes. Like the movie just hits a pause. This is where I think Parsons is a little weak in the directing, the character stuff. Renata Reinsma is just very wooden. She's very stiff. She's great at looking scared in act 2 and 3. We get there, but like, outside of the back room, outside of the back room, she's got some trauma of her own, some stuff with her mom, some childhood stuff. Her house is being torn down. That stuff's kind of its own thing. Clark, however, Chiwetel Ejiofor, wonderful. Putting the movie on his back, man. Like, he's really going big. He's doing big stuff. I love that Clark is in therapy and he's like rubbing his hands and he's like can't get comfortable and he like can't make eye contact. Like, little stuff that's so good. And that brings us into Clark at the store one night when the lights are flickering, calls the electrician. Hey, what's going on here? I don't know, man. Something must be up with the lights. He goes down one night to hit the breaker box. And that's when we stumble into Wonderland. And it's just, it's a fine act one to get us where we want to go. But every second you are in the Backrooms is gas. Every moment you're down there, it's like, this is what this needs to be. This is so good. After the first 20 minutes, the Backrooms are like, keep going. I would watch 45 minutes of just pushing further into rooms and trying to map it in my head of what's next. It reminds me a lot of, well, I'll get into influences in a second, but I think once the yellow of the back rooms, the wallpaper, the big lighting, like it creates a space that you're just not familiar with. It's uncomfortable. Like it looks like a department store, right? Or an office building, like something you've been in before, but it just never ends, right? It's terrifying. The idea that you could never get out of there, you know, it's wild work.
Right. The first time when Clark goes into the back rooms, he discovers the door and he kind of won't stop going. And it gave me so much anxiety because I was like, after his like third turn, I'm like, I'm so lost. Like, please turn around. And he just keeps going deeper and deeper. And I'm like, you're going to get lost and then you're going to be totally, totally screwed. Like, he does make it out that first time, but it gave me so much anxiety in the beginning. But I agree that the character work is what I think is most challenging about this and what definitely needs the most work, because again, the back rooms are an idea, this idea that you could fall into this liminal space of unending rooms that just continually build on each other. You could be trapped there forever and, you know, experience, run into other horrors, other people, God knows what. That, like, that's a great idea. It's scary. It's hard to build a story around it. It's hard to build characters around it. And that's what this movie is having to do. And that's what needs the most improvement for a sequel. But I think there's a lot of potential here. It could get even weirder. Like I said, bigger, more people, more about the async, the kind of explore this, the research people. It reminded me a little bit of Stranger Things in that way. It's like this research company's going in there as well. There's a lot of room to grow, but especially in the character development and story development.
It's been really cool looking at influences for Backrooms because, yeah, Parsons done a lot of interviews and talked about what he's been inspired by. The producer list on this film is really interesting. Like, it would be easy for the average fan to just be like, oh, yeah, 20-year-old Kane Parsons made this by himself. But he had a lot of help, right? He had $10 million from A24. He had James Wan, right, creator of Saw and Insidious, Malignant. He's a producer on this. We got Sean Levy, who did Deadpool Wolverine. I'm a little iffy on Levy, but even still has done a lot of big projects. He's a producer on this. Osgood Perkins, Long Legs, right? Keeper, the monkey, Osgood Perkins. Not only is he a producer, Parsons specifically cites Perkins as a notable on-set influence creatively. Perkins was on set. Hey, I think you should do this shot this way. Hey, I think you should do this that way, which is good stuff because a bit of that Mary storyline with her mom honestly reminded me a lot of Micah Monroe's weird mom in Long Legs. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the lens they use. They shoot this like wide-eyed, wild-haired woman or what, but like there's little sequences in there that I was like, this feels like Long Legs. And I get to the end and see the credits. I'm like, ah, there it is. So Parsons is being taught by some really great filmmakers right now, already on the come up. So what we're seeing isn't just this amalgamation of like internet lore, right? It started from like a photo from the back of a hobby store in Wisconsin is where Backroom started. Like it was just a photo. They were clearing out a store in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. They were like, yeah, here's a photo, 4chan, it's weird. And here we are. But also, like, he's being influenced by contemporary horror filmmakers. Like, he's being brought into this level of directing and filmmaking by people who are already on their way up. So it's cool. It's this big, like, I don't know, snowball of horror and fable and storytelling that has created something that's, like, really interesting and unique. I love the lighting in the back rooms. I know I just talked about how it looks, but, like, God, it's just so eerie. And because a lot like Exit 8, a film we covered a little while ago, another liminal space movie. Because you don't know what can be in the back rooms, you never know what you'll find around a corner, maybe a chair melted halfway into a wall or a very frightening red Christmas tree for some reason, a pool room, for God's sake. Every time a character is pushing into the back rooms, your eyes are pushing in ahead of them. You're looking down the hall to see if you see anything. You're looking around the corner. And it's so nice compared to like your generic, I don't know, slasher movie, Cabin in the Woods, kids movie, because when Jason Voorhees is outside a window and the camera's fixed on the window, I want to look away because I know the bad guy's coming. I know he's coming in that way, but I never know where anything's coming from in these liminal movies. I didn't know where the danger was coming from in X8, and I don't know where the danger's coming from in here, so I'm pushing into it with the characters. It's like you're locked in. It's great. I love that feeling. Like, this movie gets it. That movie gets it. You get a few more pushes into the back rooms over the course of the film, things get quite harrowing. It's not good. I don't want to go down there. That sucks. Like, it's bad. And I love this big theme of like memory, That's a big part of this. So we, like we said in our box office coverage at the front, Kane Parsons had a screenwriter helping him with this. I think that's where our architect and therapist kind of stuff come in here, because Parsons is 20. What does he know about 40-year-old drama? Like, is, but it's so nice that it's not just a bunch of teenagers stumbling into the back rooms with a camera. And they're like, whoa, dude, I'm going to put this on my channel. Like, it would have been so easy to make it lame, you know?
Yeah.
But instead it goes for something a little loftier. And it's this guy who's just busted and just can't figure out how to get going in life and can't find like the next step when he stumbles into this thing. And he can't wait to go tell people about it. Like, it's so odd and it's so eerie. And it, like, it gives Clark just the curiosity to be the key to unlock what's interesting about this place. Like, he's not just some hapless person. It's fascinating. Like, great, great work. I am curious about that new screenwriter, though, because maybe Parsons didn't get along with this guy. I need to go look up who it is. While you're talking, I can figure it out.
So what's interesting is, again, I went back and watched that original video, and it's only 4 years old. It's not like, you know, from 10 years ago or anything. And the thing that I picked up is, like, this is where Parsons really developed his eye for the screen. You know, in that first video, he has someone has a camera on their back and they're just walking down these different corridors and they're peeking around corners, and then, you know, some spooky stuff starts to happen. And so in the development of his YouTube series of backrooms, I can see that's where he's developed the eye for weirdness, for, you know, just kind of, you know, what will look crazy to someone watching this for 2 minutes on YouTube. And we see that in the movie. And I, again, that's why the backrooms are the best part of the film. Yes, he absolutely needs to develop a little bit more as a, you know, the character stuff. But again, he's 20, lacking a lot of life experience. I think that will get better with age. But again, if you're, I would encourage people to go back and watch the series. And it's 22 videos, about 3 hours worth of content there. So it's quite a, you know, a developed thing.
Yeah, it's, and I, for what it's worth, the other writer is Will Sudik, who has written, get this, you're going to love this, hasn't written anything in 4 years, any film or TV. He wrote one episode of Westworld season four opener of Westworld for HBO, 10 episodes of Ash versus Evil Dead over on Showtime. He wrote all of season two, every episode of season two, one episode of the show Borgia for HBO, and one episode for the show Homeland, which was on Stars. That's it. I don't know who he knows to get attached to A24 to get on with Kane Parsons for this movie, but this is handily his best credit to date. He's got a couple other projects coming up. I don't know if him and Kane didn't get along. I don't know if Kane just wants to work with somebody else. I don't know any drama about that. They might be totally cool for all I know, but for what it's worth, I think the two of them turned out something good. I do think the character stuff needs a little work on the front, just a little fine tuning, just a couple new takes or something with a little bit more energy. I know Curry Barker talked about his stress, like directing actors for Obsession not Obsession specifically, but other projects where he's directed like more actors with more experience. He directed Aaron Paul on a project, and he was like kind of weirded out to be, you know, notably younger than Paul and telling him, hey, here's how I think you should perform, because he doesn't know if he's got it right. And I think that's a bit of trepidation. Parsons doesn't want to tell Renata Ronzva how to act. She's Renata Ronzva, right? Like, same with Chiwetel Ejiofor. Like, you're not going to tell them, hey, that sucked, do this different. You know, like, I see that. I see that for sure. So I think a little bit more gas in the tank. I think you spent another half hour in the back rooms in the sequel. Do that. Do half the movie in there, man. Like, it's delightful. It is a delightful setting. Big sets they built for these things. Like, they said 35,000 feet or something of sets, which is hard to believe, but like, it's just crazy. It's crazy. And I think it's so interesting that people can tell more stories in here because nobody owns it. Nobody owns backrooms, right? It's just kind of lore or like a fable. It's just an idea. So there's a lot of potential for telling stories in here. Some kind of already do. I thought of the Severance, the show on Apple that I like watching, right? With these endless kind of hallways of people working down in R&D. And even like Us, the Jordan Peele film, was notable, kind of similar to what this is going on here. This like kind of base subterranean hallways that just go forever, you know? Like, you don't get a lot of time in there, but like, This is an idea that is so worth exploring. It's so juicy. I'm so into it. I like backrooms a lot. I think this movie is really cool. Any other thoughts or recommendations?
I'm ready.
Andy, would you recommend Backrooms?
Yes, I would, especially if you're a horror fan or into this internet lord. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought it was pretty scary in parts. It's more of a thriller in other areas. The character work story, the plot stuff could use some work, because all we want to see and be is in the back rooms. But a real movie has to do real movie stuff, like have characters and plot. So that, I think that can develop in time. I've seen this once. I definitely want to go back and see it again. So highly recommend.
Yeah, Backrooms rocks. Get it on a big screen. It's not running in IMAX, but like if you can shell out a couple bucks extra for like XD or something, like go see it on big. Getting swallowed up in this place is the best part of it. Backrooms rocks. It's a little slow in act one. Character drama is a little stiff, but it gets there. It's so worth it. Backrooms rocks. We got to talk about trailers. Action-packed Trailer Park this week. This might be the most movies we've ever done on the Trailer Park ever. I'm so excited to talk about it. Andy, bring us in here. I'm doing the first movie, though, but I guess you can do the
No,
you're doing the first movie. All right, I'm sorry. I'll get out of your way. Go ahead.
Time for the Trailer Park. So we're going to be bringing you six trailers today, but we're going to start off with Primetime, which is the Chris Hansen movie about how to catch a predator, a TV series in the 2000s or so that was this big deal, where they would make this kind of sting operation to catch sex predators. Basically, they would film, do a sting on the internet, and they'd get some old middle-aged guy come into a house to meet a teenager. And Chris Hansen would say, hey, you've been caught. And he would interview the guy for like 5-10 minutes, and then they'd arrest him. And it's a kind of a, looking back, it's a real bizarre thing to do, because it's using this, sex crimes thing for entertainment, basically. And while, yes, they did get some dangerous people off the street, it eventually ended in quite a violent tragedy, basically. And the show was taken off the air. But this reminds me a lot of Nightcrawler, it's about voyeurism and our taste for blood and those sorts of things. And we don't get a lot from the teaser, really. It's a lot of voiceover, but it's Robert Pattinson as Chris Hansen, and he's doing a freaky little voice, which Pattinson loves to do a freaky little voice. So I think that's going to be great. It's probably going to be an Oscar contender, and this is going to come out fall 2026.
Yeah, really excited for Primetime. This looks so odd. And I think it would be so easy to make like an Amazon Prime original film starring like some wacky comedian doing like doing Chris Hansen going like yikes through the whole thing. You know what I mean? And it being like, and like clown whistles and stuff. And this goes the exact opposite way, because the story of To Catch a Predator is not that long. It's only a few years this show was on television. Not only did it radically change things, it got quite violent. Things get pretty nuts. I wouldn't encourage you, if you're interested in the movie, don't go look up the Wikipedia page for To Catch a Predator, because you're going to discover some stuff that's probably going to be in here that seems vitally important to the drama of what's happening. I love Pattinson doing a weird voice. I love that it looks so strange. I love this trailer. It's these cuts of all of these screens that like look like they'd be in a production room, right? Where you see all these screens and what's going out to live television. Like, it's weird. It's twisted. It is platforming something so horrific in the sake of ratings and entertainment. It looks so cool. I'm into Primetime. I don't know. I hope it's rad. I hope the trailers hold up. It's filmed by Lance Oppenheim, who I know we saw his last movie. I cannot remember what it was, but I remember the name because Lance Oppenheim is a cool name. I'll figure it out in between stuff. Anyway, we got to talk about the trailer for Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma. If I ever thought anything was going to get us demonetized on YouTube, it might be the title for this one, or maybe yes, the trailer. This is the new Jane Schoenbrunn film. It's cool we're talking about analog horror in backrooms on this episode, because Schoenbrunn is genuinely a modern influence for this stuff, especially with We're All Going to the World's Fair, her last film, I Saw the TV Glow, which we covered on this podcast. Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma is the story of a young woman who is remaking a new film, remake of a horror slasher series set at this camp, Camp Miasma, summer camp, right? So she heads out there she's a huge fan. She had played by Hannah Einbinder. She heads out there to kind of discover maybe what it was, find a bit of that fairy dust that made those films so magical for her. And that's where she meets the original director of the series, played by Gillian Anderson, who is there, I think staying there and living there. It is dreamlike. There are paintings and huge splatters of gore. There is lust and women that are scantily clad. This movie looks so fun and so weird, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It looks like a weird midnight horror movie. It's Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma by Jane Schoenbrunn. It comes out August 7th. What do you think of the trailer, Andy?
Man, I was so excited to actually see a little bit more about this. Just like I saw the TV glow, I could not tell you what this movie is about. It's got a lot of vibes, and it just has a lot of incredible shots in it, just like their previous movie. It makes me super excited. I like this kind of meta nature of, you know, a young director going back to make another installment in this classic series. And I think Gillian Anderson might have played like the original heroine in a very kind of Jamie Lee Curtis, Laurie Strode sort of way as well. I'm super excited about it. Couldn't tell you what it's about or going to be about, but I can't wait.
Yeah, this looks really exciting. This next one we talked about last week a little. I didn't know anything about it. Now I got a trailer.
Fatherland. So this is the latest film from Polish director Paweł Pawlikowski, who we did review their previous film, Cold War, which I really love. This movie is actually really short. It's 80 minutes. But Fatherland stars Sandra Hüller and Hans Zischler as a father-daughter writing team. They're both kind of famous writers. They left Germany pre-World War II. They have returned after the war to a ruined state, and they kind of make this cross-country trip. She's a writer, but also a rally driver, apparently. I'm not really sure what this is about entirely, but Paweł Pawlikowski makes incredible films, so we're really excited to see this. It's a father-daughter story. It's also about returning home. Their allegiances are questioned about, why did you leave Germany and why did you come back? You know, did you not believe in us? That sort of thing. Can't wait for this.
Yeah, I really like the framing in the Fatherland trailer. I know it sounds silly, but it's shot like The Lighthouse. It's like almost, not 4x3, but like almost square and black and white. So it's very tall. Like a lot of these shots of like a car rolling down the street have like the car's real low in the frame, and you have a ton of landscape in the background, or like this big German architecture, right? As they're traveling and speaking in different places, like real cool. When you check out the father, like take a peek at the visuals in there, because for 80 minutes, like I think we might be treated to a bit of a feast, but we'll see. And also love Hüller. I hope it's a blast. We have to talk about the trailer for The End of Oak Street. This one is so odd. And if it was coming from anywhere else, I think it's destined to be a bomb. It might still be destined to be a bomb. But The End of Oak Street, new film coming out August 14th, stars Ewan McGregor and Anne Hathaway as a husband and wife couple with a nuclear family, a couple kids and a dog, who are living at the end of Oak Street in their small suburban American town, when suddenly a chunk of their neighborhood gets transported to primeval times. What am I trying to say? Jurassic times. Jurassic
Prehistoric.
Park. Prehistoric. It's not Jurassic Park, but it's certainly inspired by it. And The End of Oak Street, from what we can tell, appears to be a sci-fi dinosaur movie. And I see a lot of people really interested in this. A lot of people who do cinema stuff are really intrigued by this. Heard a lot of podcasts talk about this. A lot of reviewers looking forward to it, because it's strange and it kind of seems like it wouldn't work in our modern cinema landscape, when people either seem to want Star Wars or some freaky low budget horror film. Like, this wouldn't have the jaws it needs to, but it's a dinosaur movie, which we don't get a lot of nowadays, and that could be cool. B, it's looking very Spielbergian, and C, and this is the real key, it's coming from David Robert Mitchell, director of It Follows in 2014 and Under the Silver Lake in 2018. David Robert Mitchell has not made a film since these two movies. And if you saw Under the Silver Lake, we covered it on the pod, very strange, very unique, big cult following. If you saw It Follows, we covered it on the pod, very strange, very unique, big cult following, big horror. He's actually doing a sequel to that right now. Whatever's going on here, either is going to be pure cinematic gas or a huge flop. I don't know if there's an in-between. Like, it seems like we've got, like, this family using, like, rudimentary weapons and boarding up their windows and trying to figure out how they're going to get out of here. And then we're going to flash to the end of Oak Street. I don't know how they got there. I don't know why they're in prehistoric times. But something's going on here. I think this might be a general audience flop. It could be a critical darling. We don't know, but there's a lot of buzz around The End of Oak Street for people who talk movies. So we're sharing it here on the pod. That's coming out August 14th is when that's coming to theaters. What do you think, Andy?
Man, this looks kind of bad to me.
It does. It kind of looks bad. I know.
It just looks like Jurassic Park because you have people running from dinosaurs. Unfortunately, if you make a movie about that, it's just going to look like Jurassic Park. So hopefully there's maybe more going on that I don't know. Maybe it's a family drama, maybe someone else. The action scenes are cool because there's other neighbors here. You see someone like get eaten by a dinosaur, which is kind of cool in the trailer. But it just seems a little kind of paint by number. And I was like, if it's just a straight like run from dinosaur thriller, I think it's going to bomb. It's got to have more going on, I think, for people to get interested in it.
Yes, I think it is looking like it's going to flop. General audience aren't going to know what it is, right? Like if it's not if it doesn't have virality or some big word of mouth or some kind of franchise sequel prequel attached to it already, I think people don't really catch it. And like, I mean, He-Man's tracking a bomb, right? He-Man, which we're going to talk about towards the end of the podcast. He-Man is tracking a bomb right now. And people at least know what He-Man is, right? Like, they at least have a loose idea of that Saturday morning cartoon. Like, End of Oak Street has nothing. So we'll see. I don't know. David Robert Mitchell, August 14th. Keep an eye out. Two more to cover. What do you got, Andy?
How to Rob a Bank. So this trailer just came out today. This is a new film by director David Leitch, who has done a lot of action things. He previously did Bullet Train, John Wick, Deadpool 2. So this is the kind of stuff he does. I saw this poster today and I was like, that's the worst poster I've ever seen. But then I saw the trailer and it's actually pretty cool. Nicholas Holt leads a group of people who rob banks, but not for money, for content. They stream their robberies and it's all about their channel. And they're like doing flips and doing like, they're making it entertaining. It's not just for the money. And hot on their heels is the police led by John C. Reilly, who also enlists Zoe Kravitz, who's a hacker that they have on call or they make a deal with to help catch these guys as well. Really stunning cast, including Tati Gabrielle, Christian Slater, Zoe Kravitz, Pete Davidson, Anna Sawai, and more. This looks really fun. Like I said, I saw the poster. I was like, that looks awful. That looks like a straight to streaming movie. And then I saw the actual trailer. There's a lot of great action, a good crowd. Looks like there's going to be lots of, you know, fun, exciting stuff. It'll have some humor in it. This comes out September 4th. So looking forward to this.
Yeah, this kind of seemed lame on paper too. Like I kind of heard about this and was like, okay, four streamers are like, we're going to rob banks and build a channel. Like, kind of cool. It'll probably get some attention. But yeah, then you see who it's coming from and how it's driving at this like capitalism thing. And then I'm going to be honest, dude, I'm a sucker for a big John C. Reilly role. And he doesn't look like he's doing anything outstanding here, but like John C. Reilly rocks. I'm like, okay, John C. Reilly investigator. Zoe Kravitz is fun. You got that Nicholas Holt in the middle. I like him a lot. Like, I think How to Rob a Bank might be a fun time. Give me a good script. Bouncy, right? Like some kind of sincere something, and maybe lean a little bit away from like maybe the streamers have been good this whole time, maybe the banks are bad. Like, I know that's kind of where the trailer's leaning, but like maybe not so over the top. Could be a fun time. They're on masks. I played those Payday games, right? I like heist movies where you wear a mask and a suit. Like, that's why not? Sounds like a great time. Contemporary How to Rob a Bank. That's September 4th. One more for September 4th. Almost left this one off the timeline, but I think it's worth talking about. Let's talk about Onslaught. This trailer dropped today, right next to How to Rob a Bank. This is the new film from Adam Wingard, director of the last two Godzilla v. Kong movies, Godzilla v. Kong New Empire and Godzilla v. Kong, which both did great. He did that Blair Witch remake in 2016. He did The Guest, VHS 2. He did a segment of ABCs of Death. Onslaught is his new film starring Adria Arjona? As we like on the pod, as a kind of, I'm going to say, not super soldier, but very, very good soldier. Let's say very good soldier mom who's kind of returned from service and worn things down. And she's living with her daughter out of a trailer park when nearby at a government testing facility, a super soldier who's been designed to take out all threats, foreign and domestic, awakens and breaks out. And before the government can get control of him, he sets out to start murking every nearby great warrior in the area. And this includes our gal, Adria Arjona. So it's a big battle. You gotta kill or be killed, I guess. honestly, it doesn't look that good. Honestly, but I'm interested because it's Adam Wingard and it's what he's making next. I'm like, okay, well, I was the last two Godzilla v. Kong movies weren't too bad. I like Adrian Arjona. I don't know. He got some guns. Maybe it's a good time. Oh, and notably, this film is another classic mistake. Hides actor Dan Stevens. Dan Stevens is in this movie. He's doing a German scientist accent through the trailer here. You never get a look at him, as far as I know. And he's last listed in the credits. Huge mistake. He's probably just doing a small role, but like Dan Stevens is a big name. He'll probably be in the follow-up trailer. We'll see. What do you think of the trailer for Onslaught, Andy?
I thought the same thing as you. I thought this looks really kind of lame. It's like a plot out of the 80s. I'm sure the action will be really good and over the top and all this. But I was getting bored watching the trailer. And then like I said, this comes out the same day, September 4th, as How to Rob a Bank. And that I would much rather go and see that one. September is a weird month, or like the 6 weeks after summer, like middle of August to October. It's probably the worst month for movies. That being said, the Oscar winner came out last year during September, but usually September is a pretty light month at the movies, and we're real struggling. It's a dumping ground, even more so than January has become.
Yeah, well, it's coming out September 4th. I'm with Andy. I think if we're going to cover anything for the pod, it's probably How to Rob a Bank. But I want to put it on your radar. I don't know. Maybe Wingard will turn out something great. Maybe reviews will come out and get a 96 on Rotten. People will be like, oh my God, there's something here we didn't know. But for that, man, that's such a big trailer park. Six trailers we covered on the pod. Fall, August, September, lots of good stuff. We got to talk about one more thing on the pod. Normally we do another film here. This week it's TV. Andy, what are we doing?
Spider-Noir. So this is the Amazon Prime MGM TV show about Ben Reilly, formerly known as the Spider, and he is a variant of Spider-Man. We first met Ben Reilly in Across or Into the Spider-Verse, the 2017 hit, and Ben Reilly is this 1930s like noir detective, and he talks like he's in the 30s, and he's in black and white in the animated film, and he, like, there's always wind blowing, and it's a really fun interpretation of the character. And so now Sony and Amy Pascal have licensed this character to Amazon MGM to make this show, and that's how we got here. He was voiced by Nicolas Cage in the Across the Spider-Verse films, and he plays him here now in the TV series. So what is actually going on? In episode one, we meet Ben Reilly, a down and out private eye, struggling to make ends meet, not really too good at his job. He has hung up the mask, which made me immediately go, oh no. Are we getting Surf Dracula?
Yeah.
Meaning he's not going to become Spider-Man till the end of the series. But he has put down the mask after suffering a personal tragedy. Again, he's an interpretation of Spider-Man, so there's a lot of parallels. And he's no longer the Spider. He's no longer the savior of the city. He is merely a detective, hung up the mask 5 years ago. He gets recruited. The plot gets real complicated real fast, but he gets recruited to chase someone who has powers, who can set things on fire. And that opens up a whole litany of other plots and other characters. We meet a kingpin-esque character called Silvermaid, played by Brendan Gleeson. We have the femme fatale, Kat Hardy, played by Lee Joon Lee, who you might recognize from Sinners. So this is how we start. And if you watch it, you'll see parallels to the Spider-Man mythos and other characters we see in the main Spider-Man timeline. We get some action, we get some mystery, we get some 30s. Also importantly, you can watch this in either black and white or in true hue color. You get both options, which is an interesting option. So Zach, what'd you think of the first two episodes of Spider-Noir?
So, like Andy said, we're covering the first two episodes here on the pod. You can watch the show in black and white or true hue HD color. I watched first episode black and white. I watched the second one in color. I was just curious. I'll just see the difference. I'm gonna be honest, I'm not warm on this show. I'm not really into this. And I was really surprised going looking at like the Rotten score and the critic scores, like how warm people seem to be. Rotten's got like a 70 something, but then you go look at individual reviews and people are not that kind. The noir stuff is kind of where it's leaning. It's a bit more noir story and a bit less Spider-Man, and then the Spider-Man's just kind of laid on top. But mostly you've got, yeah, this private investigator who's trying to figure out this case. This dame comes by. He's, like, smoking his cigarette. He's like, what do you need, doll? Right? Like, all that stuff's in there. That's great. Yeah, you got your Kingpin character, like you said, Silverman, Brendan Gleeson. But, like, it just kind of doesn't work. And it's for a number of reasons, mostly because this is mostly just kind of a flash in the pan thing. I don't think this is meant to be anything serious. This is not meant to be a film. You're not going to have to remember this one the next time you walk into Spider-Man. Like, this is a total fluff story, imaginative, you know, what would happen kind of thing. And Nick Cage signing on for that's great. But it just doesn't work. It's less than the sum of its parts. I think Cage's performance is a little stunted. I think the show moves too fast to really lean on any of its noir trappings. It's got a lot of like Dutch angles, and like the black and white looks kind of cool. And it's got these big spotlights like they used to have back then. But like, it doesn't really work that way either. Like, I'm kind of not into it. I'm kind of not into spider noir. What'd you think?
I was with episode one. I was really worried about this being Surf Dracula. He does pick up the mask in episode two, so I don't think that that's necessarily the case. He becomes a spider again pretty quickly. I struggled with this a little bit. It's a little slow. It's a little boring. Amazon shows, I feel, they fall between HBO and Netflix. Like, they're not quite as good as a prestige HBO show. They're not as bad as a lot of Netflix shows, and that's kind of where this lands. The plot, there's a ton going on in the plot. Like, I watched the first episode last week, and then I watched the second episode today, and I was like, the mystery is just not enough of a mystery. It's a lot of, well, so-and-so was hired to do this. Well, who hired them? And that's what we're chasing after. And again, we have the pieces of the noir film with the femme fatale, some violence, but it's just kind of a character of that genre. I don't know what Nicolas Cage is doing in his performance. He's the only person kind of doing a 30s accent. Like, you can't walk in here, Shay. He's like no one else is doing that. Everyone else feels like they're in the right series. And I don't know what he's doing. Also, any stunt work is very clearly a stunt double.
It's bad.
We do have some fun other characters. Lamorne Morris, who you might know from New Girl, is in here as Robbie Robertson, a reporter for the newspaper. Lee Joon Lee, I think, is effective as Cat Hardy, as is Brendan Gleeson as Silvermane. So, like, Cage is getting upstaged by his supporting cast all around him. So I think he just it's a weird decision, and it just kind of doesn't work. I'm really bored after the second episode. I might give it another episode or two, but it is not working for me so far.
Yeah, I wasn't really on board with Gleeson. I can appreciate them trying to stick in spider villains and be like, ooh, it hinted, you know, maybe Electro will show up or the Sandman. Like, okay, sure. Like, it's going to be a big showdown by episode eight, but like, it doesn't look very good. And honestly, I thought watching the first episode in black and white, I thought episode two will be better because it's color. I'll just be more locked in, right? They said it's an old trick on your cell phone. If you want to use your smartphone yet less, you just turn everything to grayscale. So your brain won't get activated by the colors and you won't be as into it. So I thought, well, episode two, all color, going to be locked in. No, I actually might have been worse. The effects, I think, look worse in color. I was like, oh no, like the black and white hides some of that CGI. And like, it looks a little better. I thought Sandman looked a little better. And then you see it in color and you're like, ew, the sand's like gray and black. Like, that's not right. Like, I don't know. It just looks, I know, it just looks odd. Gleason's fine. I like Lamorne Morris. I really do. But yeah, Cage, I think, is the problem, ultimately. He's kind of what doesn't work here. He is way too low energy. Everybody else knows they're in a Marvel production, except Cage, who's like way turned down. And he talked about how he hasn't done TV before, really. Like, he hasn't done a lot of TV, and the reason he did it is because his son showed him Breaking Bad. And he looked at Bryan Cranston's performance as Walter White and realized, hey, you know what, in television, you get more time to draw out a character. You get more time to draw out a pause, more time to draw out a silence. So what Cage brings to set is a quieter, more patient character. Ben Reilly is nearly retired. He hung up the suit years ago. Like again, he said, kind of looks like we're doing Surf Dracula. So he's more tamped down, and it doesn't work because the editing is not for a noir show. The editing is for a Marvel show where we got to have a cut every 10 seconds, and that's not what noir is. The better send-up of, like, noir, I think, on television of late, I think the thing everybody seems to point out when they talk about the show is Perry Mason over on HBO. They did that show, 3 seasons of it. It's really great. It's a great watch. It's big. It's interesting. It's strange. And, God, what is the name of the guy at the center of Perry Mason? It's escaping me now. I had it when I started talking, and I've lost it. Anyway.
He was on the OC. I can't remember his name.
He was on
Ben
the OC.
Something?
Are you thinking of the same guy as on the OC? No, I think it's a different guy. I think you're confusing men. All right, hold on. Stand by, pod listeners. We're going to figure it. Somebody somewhere knows this, and they're screaming at their... Matthew Rhys. You're thinking of the guy who's doing the crypto thing. Ben, what's his name? I don't know. Now we sound like crazy people. Anyway, Matthew Rhys plays Perry Mason. And he's got the time. It's cut like an HBO show. He has the time to, like, sit and smoke a cigarette for a minute in a take. You know what I mean? Like, this is not that way. So, like, Cage is turned down too low. The action is where he starts to light up because you get some action. But, dude, it is so, like, strugglingly, obviously, a stuntman. Like, they do this sequence in the open where he's like, 5 years ago, I was the Spider-Noir, but now I'm not. And, like, they show, like, a sequence of, like, our spider, like, beating up some guys in a bank, and the guy is like, the stuntman's like rail thin. He's like thin as a pencil. Like, he's like swinging on guys. He does like a flip, and then it cuts to Cage, and he's wearing 6 overcoats because they're trying to hide like the mass. Like, they're trying to hide how thick the man is because he's like 80, and that's fine. Like, it's fine. You can't have it both ways though. You cannot have him just throw on the mask and cut to thin stunt guy. Like, it doesn't work the same way. Even with the overcoats, you try to pat him out. He's just not the same guy in the suit as he is out of it. And, like, that's not going to pull me in. Like, it doesn't pull me in. Sorry, I've complained way too much about Cage. Your turn. Please, take this away from me.
Right. I mean, I'm kind of the target audience for this. I'm a big comic book fan, love Spider-Man, big fan of the Across the Spider-Verse movies. And this just isn't doing it for me. It's missing elements. At least they're kind of short. They're 40, 45 minutes of episodes. But the fact that a 40-minute episode and I was like getting on my phone because I was just like really bored through the middle of it. And by the time we actually get some spider action, it's a little lame. It's a little watered down. Like, you really got to put a lot of effort into those. I was thinking about, you know, the best scenes in The Boys where we get a lot of that superhero action. It's really great stuff. And we're not really getting a lot of that. And also, just the story is just not interesting so far. You're not like, whoa, who was responsible for this? Like, it's not a good mystery either.
Yeah, that's a big part of noir, right? Like, there's some kind of murder or something goes wrong. And then over the course of it, you figure out and then you uncover at the end, all the pieces fall into place. I'm not interested. You didn't hook me in 2 episodes. Like, I'm not interested in where this is going. Like, I feel like I can see the shape of it. We're going to have a bunch, a few more Spider-Man villains weave in and out before ultimately we find out that this guy Silverman, he's really up to no good. I don't know. Like, I just am not, I don't know. It has not pulled me in. It has not grabbed me. I'll bet if we could see Amazon's metrics, you would see people start this show because it seems so cool. The imaging looks great. The black and white or true HD thing is cool, albeit a little confusing. Not 2 separate things on Amazon Prime. You click the one player and then it asks you which way you want to watch it in. So if you're watching, that's how you get there. Don't go looking for the black and white version like I did, like an idiot. I think, like, that all looks great in marketing, but then you actually watch it and you're like, you're on your phone like in a half hour. Good luck getting through the first 2 episodes and staying locked in on this. The drop-off's got to be insane. People are not sticking around to watch this. I'm surprised the reviews are as kind as they are. Like, really. I don't know. It's just weird. But Spider-Noir, your mileage may vary, I guess. Any other thoughts or recommendations?
I'm going to say, this is not a kid-friendly show. Like, there's a lot of pretty graphic violence through. It's definitely aimed at adults. So keep that in mind. It's not a kid show at all.
Yeah. Andy, would you recommend Spider-Noir?
I'm going to give this a soft pass. I watched the first 2 episodes. It's a little slow. It's a little boring. The mystery at hand isn't really compelling. I don't know what Cage is doing as far as his performance. It's really, like you said, it's low energy. He's the only one doing a 30s accent. Everyone else is pretty good. The supporting cast is great. But I don't know what he's doing. So I'm going to say soft pass.
Yeah, I think it's a pass for me too. If you don't believe us, watch episode one. Throw in episode one and tell me you don't end up bored. Like, it just kind of doesn't work. Cage is at the wrong level of energy for what everybody else is doing. I don't believe that when he puts on the mask, that's the same guy I was just looking at. Like, Ben Reilly feels disconnected. It's not, it's cut too fast to be noir. It's shot too slow to be anything else. Spider-Noir is misguided. It feels like a miss. And that's episode 338 of Off Script Film Review. Good Lord, Andy, Don, and Dustin, what are we watching next week?
We're going to be taking a look at Masters of the Universe, the He-Man movie starring Nicholas Galitzin, that's coming out this weekend. It's supposed to be a big family thing. It's a huge, but it's like, almost a $200 million movie, real expensive. We fear it's not going to do too well, but we've heard good things. It has a great director who's worked with the Leica studio. So we're going to be checking that out. We're also going to be taking a look at Hokum, which was the Adam Scott horror movie from the beginning of May that's hitting streaming today, actually. So we're going to be taking a look back. That's one we didn't catch at the beginning of the month. Some FYI releases, Scary Movie 6, comes out this weekend as well, looking to be probably the most unfunny movie of the year. And also, just another FYI release, Eruptia, which is Charlie XCX's recent film, which takes place in Poland. She's wandering around Poland trying to avoid her fiance from proposing to her. That's all I know about it. It's in Polish. That's out on VOD this week as well. Don't know much about that, but I'm a big Charlie XCX fan, so I might be watching that as well. But for next week, Masters of the Universe and Hokum on streaming/VOD.
Yeah, it might be a double bomb episode, because I know Hokum was kind of a bomb when it came out. And yeah, He-Man is tracking to be a bomb, which is a shame, because I keep seeing good reviews for it. People keep saying, like, this seems like it's just going to be a sore miss, because it seems like the movie's actually made well. We'll see. I'm skeptical about Scary Movie. I've had some people ask if we're going to cover it on the pod. I don't know a lot about those movies, to be honest. It doesn't look very funny. It looks like it's going to hit in all the horror realms and the teens, but like I don't laugh at the trailers. They're not funny.
So let me, because I was there Scary Movie happened. And it happened in the same year as Scream in 1996. That's when these movies came out, and they were immediately, riffing parodies of the horror genre. And they were these kind of stoner boner comedies and very, like, politically incorrect, real gross out stuff. And they were huge hits. And those originals are really pretty funny. They were funny then. Some of those jokes have actually stood the test of time. That was 30 years ago. And I don't know if that kind of humor is going to, work in 2026, but also you got to be really quick. Like, it took longer to make movies then, so you could parody something 2 years later and it would still be relevant. But half of the references, you're like, this is already dated. So I don't really know if it's going to work. And a lot of the dynamic between our two main characters, Anna Faris and Regina Hall, I know that relationship, but I don't know that modern audiences did. So I don't really know how this is going to do.
Yeah, we're going to keep an eye on it. We'll keep you posted. But next week, Master of the Universe, Hokum. If you like Off Script, if you like what we're doing here on the pod, subscribe to the show. Come on, you've been thinking about it. We've told you to do it before, and you were like, yeah, I'll do it next week. It's easy, I swear. You just got to find the button somewhere on wherever you're listening to this and hit it. But once you find that, you're set, and you're going to get us in your ears every single week. We will come to you automatically. And it doesn't cost anything. The F-R-E-E free, huh? It's the best thing ever. You can also find us on social media, at Off Script Film Review on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram. Come give us a follow. Come engage with the show. Tell us what you watched lately. Shoot us a DM. I promise we read them. We love talking about this stuff. Check out our YouTube channel, where we're uploading new stuff every single week, youtube.com/offscriptfilmreview. I don't actually know if that's an accurate URL. I just said that. I'm going to be honest. Probably isn't. I bet that doesn't actually go to us, but we're somewhere in there, and you can find us over on YouTube, where we're posting new clips, new shorts every single week. Offscriptfilmreview.com is our website, where we got new content. We got interviews. There's all kinds of stuff going on over there, and you can shoot us correspondence directly, mail at offscriptfilmreview.com right into the show. We'll probably read you on the air. Why not? We can make a segment. We'll make a thumbnail ad. We'll put on that YouTube channel. It'll be sick. You'll be a viral sensation, I'm sure. That's Off Script episode 338. Thanks for listening. Go check out Backrooms. Spider-Noir. That's it. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.